You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Peter Franklin had been running a successful woodworking business on Lanai, Hawaii, when Larry Ellison, one of the richest people on the planet, bought nearly the entire island for about $300 million. This was back in 2012.
There are feelings of both angst and excitement as Lanai residents prepare to welcome new billionaire owner Larry Ellison.
Larry Ellison loves to go shopping for big things. He even bought a Hawaiian island recently.
In his first interview since buying Lanai 3 months ago, Larry Ellison shows he's as ambitious as he is rich.
The news meant that Peter had a new landlord. And at first, things went relatively well. For one, he had a new spendy client. Ellison's people asked Peter to make some furniture and hired his shop, Lanai Woodworkers, for one of his first projects on the island, building a Nobu. You know, the Japanese restaurant known for its celebrity sightings. Here's Peter remembering one of the earlier projects he did for Ellison.
Mr. Ellison was starting to spend more time here. And the story was he didn't like rectangular or square tables. He didn't like corners. And so they wanted this massive round table. And like so many other jobs, we did it. We got it done. It was a nice table. Massive, though.
The Nobu job was finished 6 months after Ellison bought the island. Chris Andrus, one of Peter's employees, remembers meeting Ellison for the first time during its opening in late December of that year.
We were down there for the soft opening. And at one point, I had to go to the restroom, so I pushed my chair back and bumped into someone. Oh, I apologize. I'm so sorry. And I turn around. Here's this scrubby-looking guy. I couldn't even believe he was there. Flannel shirt, hadn't shaved. And he says, oh, I'm Ellison. And I said, oh, Mr. Ellison, well, we did these walls. We're Lanai woodworkers. We did your hostess stand. He shakes my hand and says, we're going to do great work together. January 1st, we had the distinction of being the first company that he killed.
The first company he kills, but not the last. And it would be a slow death. Ellison's management company, Pulama Lanai, which means to cherish Lanai, first came to Peter with an ultimatum. Either he could sell his business to Pulama or vacate the building.
When Mr. Ellison bought the island, they came to me and said, listen, we own this building. We want to use the building. You can work for us or you can go do something else.
For Peter, the choice was simple. Keep doing what he'd been doing for years. He sold the business and worked for Ellison for another 6 years. Then, out of nowhere, again, Ellison's company decided to shut down Lanai Woodworkers entirely.
Matsumoto called me into his office. And it was a surprise to me. He called me into his office and told me he was closing a wood shop.
Kurt Matsumoto is the president of Ellison's management company.
After that, I asked Kurt if we could buy any of the equipment, and he told me no. He recommended I leave the island, and I was kind of shattered by that. I kind of made up my mind, well, I guess I'm not leaving.
The problem for Peter is he might not have a choice in the matter. Ellison also owns the apartment where he lives, and there's a stipulation in the billionaire's residential leases that if you work for one of the landlord's companies and are fired, that's grounds to terminate your lease. In other words, Ellison could kick him out of his apartment at any time.
So you're always holding your breath. They could easily say, well, listen, you don't work for us anymore. You have to vacate.
And so it goes on an island owned by a man who's so rich that if he wanted to, he could afford to buy Lanai 300 times over.
Jobless claims coming in, I mean, really jumping from the week before. Pretty brutal, 3.2 million.
A record 6.6 million Americans filed for unemployment last week.
Indian working women were the worst impacted by the pandemic.
Well, now to the billionaire boom.
According to Bloomberg, super yacht charters are up over 340%.
And a billionaire was created every 26 hours during this pandemic.
Larry Ellison loves to go shopping for big things. He even bought a Hawaiian island recently.
No, I'm not waiting in line for a COVID test with the public. Gross.
It is time for a wealth tax in America.
Welcome back to The Paycheck. I'm Rebecca Greenfield. The growth in wealth inequality around the world in recent decades has been driven by explosive wealth creation at the very top. Before the pandemic, billionaire wealth was booming. In 2020, the top 20 richest people in the world held as much wealth as half of humanity. That's almost 4 billion people. Then, during the pandemic, that gap got much wider. Here's Nabil Ahmed, a strategist from Oxfam International.
This pandemic, we're witnessing the biggest increase in billionaire wealth since records began. In fact, billionaire wealth has increased more during the pandemic than it has in the 14 years combined. And a billionaire was created every 26 hours.
A year into the pandemic, it only took 10 billionaires to get all the wealth held by half of humanity. Wealth isn't inherently bad, and a lot of people argue that billionaires have benefited society by innovating, creating jobs, new companies, and they were in part incentivized to do that by the prospect of getting very wealthy. Many of them also use their money to give back in ways that better the world, by, for example, funding research that creates things like vaccines. But money is power, and increasingly, one group of people is accumulating so much wealth that in some ways, it can bend the world to its whims, at the expense of others. One such billionaire is Larry Ellison. According to Bloomberg's Billionaires Index, which tracks billionaire wealth, he's worth around $90 billion, depending on the day. That's nearly double what he had before the pandemic. Ellison made his money as the co-founder of Oracle, a software company. He's part of a new generation of scions, wealthier and more powerful due to a soaring stock market that has primarily benefited American technology giants. They have an unfathomable amount of wealth to most people, even probably themselves. Ellison may be best known for how he spends his money. Mansions, yachts, a tennis tournament, and buying 98% of the island of Lanai, the two Four Seasons resorts there, around a third of its housing stock, and practically all the commercial properties. Plenty of wealthy people own private islands, but Lanai stands out. It's home to around 3,000 people, many whose families have lived there for generations. Overnight, when he first bought it back in 2012, most of those people got a new boss or a new landlord, or both. Now they have a new neighbor. In 2020, like many office workers stuck in their homes during lockdowns, Ellison relocated to one of his many properties on Lanai. With the billionaire's attention focused on the island now more than ever, residents are anxious. None of them wants to become the next Lanai woodworkers. Sophie Alexander, a reporter on Bloomberg's wealth team, went to Hawaii to see how things are playing out.
There's a reason people conjure images of Hawaii's sandy beaches, sunny blue skies, and rolling green mountains when they think of paradise. Lanai is no different. Approaching the island on the ferry from Maui's Lahaina Harbor, its hills look buttery soft. The Pacific water that surrounds it is a deep blue, so clear in some parts you can see the ocean floor. And a ring of clouds hovering around the island's mountain peak is called Mauna Lea, because it looks like the island is wearing a lei, the Polynesian flower garland. It's idyllic. So it's easy to see why someone would want to buy a Hawaiian island if they could.
We know that you've made tons of headlines recently, buying an island in Hawaii, Lanai, buying tons of homes. How many homes do you own right now? 15 or 11?
Let's see. Homes that I live in are...
Why do you buy the homes if you don't live in them?
Well, for example, I bought a home in Newport, Rhode Island, which I'm converting into a 19th century European art museum.
Larry Ellison didn't respond to my emails asking to talk to him for this story. And his management company didn't make any of its executives available to me. We did find this one interview he did on CNBC back in 2012. Back then, he said he wanted to make Lanai a sustainable paradise and help locals start small businesses. He also goes on and on about his plans for his own art museums and his desire as a kid to be a pilot, which is why he now has his own planes to fly. But Lanai isn't just a mansion or a jet. It's a community, and one small decision from Ellison can change everything. It's like a real-life version of Sims, the world-building video game. Now, a decade has passed, and Ellison and his company have changed a lot on Lanai. Lanai Woodworkers closed, so did the family-owned pokey shop and the car rental business, and, more recently, the cafe down the street. Most say they were given no explanation for their demise.
In and of itself, when they buy this business or take over this business, doesn't seem much. But in totality, that is a concern from an economic standpoint and just from the, I think, from the perception residents have of what they're doing and how much control they have. Is it the metaphor I'm looking at is throwing a crab in a pot of cold water and turning on the stove and they don't realize that they're being boiled to death?
That's Butch Gima, a retired social worker who grew up on the island and is one of the most vocal members of the community. We're in Dole Park, the quasi-town square of Lanai City, which got its name from James Dole, who bought the island in 1922. 100 years ago, Dole decided to turn the island into the world's largest pineapple plantation.
So yeah, I mean, the pineapple dictated how life went, you know, here in our community. And Dole Pineapple, I mean, they basically took care of everything. They ran the barge to and from Oahu. They kind of ran the clinic. They ran the hospital. I mean, they ran everything. So they had a lot of control over what happened in town.
Butch grew up on the island during plantation days, when everything was regulated by the company. Whistles marked the start of a workday, and whistles marked the 8 p.m. curfew. The control over seemingly every aspect of life and the dependence on the company for families' well-being created what locals still refer to as a plantation mentality.
What exists in the plantation is this idea that if you work for the plantation, you don't speak out against them. And that holds true no matter what to this day.
That's Solomon Pilikaho'o Halahala, a seventh-generation Lanaian who goes by Saul. He also grew up during the plantation days.
My parents then were both the workers of the pineapple plantation. My mother was a pineapple picker, and my father became a heavy equipment operator and a truck driver irrigating the pineapple fields.
For Saul, there was one instance in particular that crystallized the wealth gap between Lanai's residents and Lanai's owners, a divide that's only grown bigger with Ellison.
I took a part-time job in the evening. I did bartending as a part-time, you know. And on one day, a group of people came in to have lunch. And they were an unusual group of people because the women had mink stoles on. And I was serving their drinks. So they were ordering martinis for lunch. And then when they were getting ready to leave after their lunch, they were walking out with their martini glasses. And as a bartender, I decided, I better go and retrieve the glasses. So I started to walk out of the hotel. And then the manager saw me, and then she stopped me, and she says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to go and get the martini glasses from those people that are leaving. And then she stopped me, and she says, no, let them go. And I said, why? They're taking our glasses. And she says, these are the board of directors for the Dole Company. That helped me to realize that this plantation was supporting the people that were having martini lunches. And so I asked her, I said, so they're leaving right now. Are they going to go into the pineapple fields to thank my mother and my father for what they do to give them their flaunting wealth? And she says, I don't think so. And then I was crushed at that moment.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Dole closed its plantation in 1992 after its parent company was bought by a billionaire named David Murdoch. Murdoch is what locals now call a poor billionaire. He was only worth a couple billion dollars compared to Ellison's roughly $90 billion fortune. People told me they remember Murdoch routinely complaining about how much money he was losing from the island. Ultimately, when he could no longer afford to keep it running, he sold it to Ellison. But Murdoch's impact on the island was enormous. He's the one who built the two hotels and oversaw the transition from pineapples to tourism. The change wasn't easy, and he tangled with many of Lanai's residents during his reign, often getting into screaming matches with locals. But unlike Ellison, people here told me the island's previous owner was at least willing to talk to them face to face.
For me, that is a relationship, and that is one that allows us to interact, whether we agree or disagree. I've had that relationship with Murdoch, because when he was wrong, when he had no idea about it, I wouldn't hesitate to tell him. And he would always tell me, you know, you're a thorn in my side, you know. And I took that as a compliment.
Now, with Ellison, it's a completely different story. Saul remembers approaching the president of Ellison's company to ask for a meeting with the new owner.
I said, Kurt, I would like to request a meeting with Ellison in person. Kurt's response to me, and I'll never forget this. He says, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but that is not Ellison's style. Those are his exact words. They've been ingrained in me from that very moment. And my response to Kurt was, first of all, that is disrespectful, but beyond that, I still have an expectation that we need to sit down and meet, you know. And so I make my request. So I've been waiting now for 10 years to have a conversation just to get to meet this person who somehow this mystic and this mover and shaker in a community of which we don't get to see or know. And my requests have never been acknowledged or responded to.
I also asked to speak with Kurt Matsumoto, the president of Ellison's management company, but he didn't respond to my emails. A spokesperson for Pulama did suggest I talk to Diane Preza, who acts as a liaison between the company and the community. She didn't seem to want to talk much about Ellison's plans, but she was the only person from Ellison's company who agreed to be interviewed, so I had to ask.
Do you feel like you have a broad sense of what the plans Pulama has for the community are?
You know, things change at Pulama all the time, so I hate to say something and then it doesn't happen, you know?
I guess, like, long-term plans, you know?
I would say no.
While the uncertainty is scary for people like Saul and Butch, who have lived on Lanai for decades, there's more at stake for the younger generation that worries about its future here on the island. Take Michelle Fugier, a 38-year-old high school math teacher who grew up here and is raising her two kids here. She loves Lanai and enthusiastically offered to drive me around to show me her favorite parts of the island. Like pretty much everyone else here, her speedometer rarely topped 25 miles an hour, and it seemed like she waved at every passing car and person.
Let's see if Auntie wants a ride because she's walking in the rain. Sorry.
Mm-hmm, that's
great. Auntie, you like one ride? It's raining.
That's okay, I'm fine.
You sure? Okay, you go, girl, with your exercise.
Everyone seems to know everyone here. People refer to their elders as aunties and uncles. I routinely saw people hugging. A stranger even invited me to his kid's birthday party on the beach. Ellison's not part of any of that, and it doesn't go unnoticed.
I think a big difference between Murdoch and Ellison is just the connection to the community. Like maybe it's like, you know how there's like the five love languages and what is your best like love language? And so maybe Murdoch was like words of affirmation or service, you know, where he would actually come out or quality time and spend time with the community members. Like people knew him by like first name. And, you know, whenever he would come home, like, sure, there's still that plantation boss mentality and everybody bow down and, you know, praise you. But at the same time, it's like people knew who he was. When you seen his face, you would recognize him and he would greet you. Ellison is a little bit different. I've never met him.
Without any insight from Ellison, that leaves Michelle to fill in the blanks about how his company's plans will affect her life.
I don't think that I'm fully, like, if I had to put my money on whether or not Pulama is solely in it for the best interest of our community, I would not put my whole fortune on it. You know what I mean?
Since the pandemic started, more rich people seem to be moving to the island. Michelle is worried about the community becoming more divided economically.
One of my biggest fears is that the people of this community will sort of be the ones that would be caring for the elite rich that can't afford to actually live here one day. And that's our sole purpose. Like, as an educator, you would think that we would want our students to graduate and aspire to be more than just somebody's servant.
Michelle and her fiancé have three kids between the two of them and are excited about getting married. But she says it's getting impossible to find housing, especially after Ellison moved to the island and the pace of his construction projects have picked up. All those projects need people to build them, which means more construction workers living on the island, taking up the already limited housing options.
There's no houses. Really isn't any homes that we could affordably rent, you know? Like, I think now if we were to try and find a house that was being rented by some local family, we would be paying like $2,000-$3,000 a month, because that's what construction workers would pay, or that's what, you know, the market would allow for.
To alleviate the housing crunch, Ellison is building more homes on the island. The plan initially had units for sale, but something changed, and now they're all only for rent. At first, Michelle was against the project because of the change and the fact that the units will all be fully furnished, making it feel like they're for outsiders moving to the island temporarily. But with her wedding coming up, she's desperate for options.
that's where my sway changed, you know? Like, then it's like, okay, well, if we're thinking about a future as a married couple and we're not able to live together unless we, you know, I don't want to say sell out because it's not really selling out because we're not really selling anything, but it definitely changed my perspective of things versus it just being like, you know, we got to think about ways that we're going to merge our family, and that right now would be a solution.
Younger families like Michelle's have been moving off the island recently. Michelle said she worries that if she did leave and gave up her housing and her job, then there'd be no way for her or her kids to return because everything is becoming so expensive. And there are so few employment opportunities outside of working for the billionaire. Around the world, as the rich get richer and decide to move into your neighborhood, changing it to fit their tastes, people often throw around the word gentrification. But on Lanai, it goes beyond that, because it ultimately comes down to the tastes of one person who increasingly dictates who and what is allowed on his island. And in this version of gentrification, you're not pushed further from the city center. You're pushed into the ocean. And who knows if you can come back.
When I first started reporting on this season of The Paycheck, an economist named Gabriel Zuckman told me something that stuck with me. He said, if you think about it, extreme wealth inequality is inefficient. To someone like Larry Ellison, an extra $1 billion doesn't change his life that much. But that amount of money for the thousands of people on the island, it would drastically change their lives.
When you own $100 billion, it's just useless. Like, it's not changing their lifestyle. It has no meaning. And whereas an extra billion, you know, that could be, I don't know, paid in taxes, spent on education, on healthcare, on infrastructure, that is valuable.
Next week on The Paycheck, we head to a place where the government's decisions about how to manage the pandemic had unintended consequences for women.
I mean, as public health professionals, we must do better. We have to educate people. We have to educate communities. We have to educate parteras. It would be amazing if we can help them to work together with the physicians, for them to learn more and to be working together.
Thanks for listening to The Paycheck. If you like our show, please head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and rate, review, and subscribe. This episode was hosted by me, Rebecca Greenfield, and reported by Sophie Alexander. It was edited by Shelley Banjo with help from Francesca Levy, Janet Paskin, Rakshita Saluja, and me. We also had editing help from Danielle Balbi, Kristen V. Brown, Gilda DeCarli, Nicole Flato, Alyssa McDonald, and Kai Schultz. This episode was produced by Gilda DeCarli and sound engineered by Matt Keim. Our original music is by Leo Sidran. Special thanks to Magnus Henriksen, McKinnon DeKuyper, Margaret Sutherland, Stacey Wong, and Aisha Diallo. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. See you next week.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.